Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Today, we will be talking live with Cohoes resident Joseph Ritchie about the imminent delivery of several tanker trucks of AFFF being delivered to the Norlite facility tomorrow.
Then, we'll get an update from Troy Mayor Patrick Madden.
After that, I have an interview with independent filmmaker Sonia Stark about her short film Albany Alert.
And then we'll be learning some stress reduction techniques from Kelsey Mathis.
And finally, Brenda Robinson discusses the need for accountability over health disparities in communities of color. But first, some of today's headlines.
The Times Union reported on Monday that 12 tanker trucks containing a total of nearly 700,000 gallons of toxic firefighting foam are headed to the Norlite facility in Cohoes on Tuesday, despite the Cohoes Local Law 4, which establishes a one-year moratorium on burning AFFF. Norlite's parent company, Tradebee, which is based in Spain, has a five-year contract with the Department of Defense to dispose of the AFFF waste.
Governor Cuomo over the weekend weakened the rules related to allowing regions to open their economy. So the Capital Region and Western New York are expected to begin reopening this week. However, other parts of the country that have begun to reopen have seen a surge in COVID-19 cases. Phase one allows non-essential manufacturing, construction, and retail businesses to reopen, but with social distancing and density reduction precautions in place. Retail is only allowed curbside or in-store pickups.
The Times Union reports, despite facing at least a $10 billion deficit, Governor Cuomo has not proposed furloughs or layoffs in the state workforce, even as tens of thousands of government employees have been directed to work from home, including many with sharply reduced job duties. Increasingly, Cuomo has asserted that it is the role of the federal government to rescue New York and other states from the financial crisis.
Though House Democrats on Friday passed a $3 trillion stimulus bill built around aid for local governments and a fresh batch of direct payments to the public, the Republican Senate majority has no immediate plans to produce an alternative. Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins criticized the Democrats for failing to include funding for initiatives to address the climate crisis, as many European countries have done.
The Williams Company announced that it will not seek to refile its application for its gas pipeline that would run under New York Harbor after both New York and New Jersey for the third time rejected the permit. Governor Cuomo cited New York's new climate law in rejecting the permit.
Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan announced that she will forgo her salary for the remainder of 2019 due to the city's large budget gaps during the COVID-19 crisis. In a statement, Mayor Sheehan continued, quote, "My team and I continue to go through the painful process of identifying cuts that the city of Albany will have to make if the federal government fails to provide direct emergency aid to local governments," end quote.
And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. For our first segment, and despite Cohoes passing a ban on the incineration of AFFF, a dozen tanker trucks containing 38,000 gallons each of firefighting foam are headed from Cohoes tomorrow. And now we have live on the phone Cohoes resident Joseph Ritchie to talk about these trucks. Hi, Joseph. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Joseph, can you give us an overview of what the situation is?
Yeah, so this morning I woke up to see on my phone that the tankers are coming to Cohoes with these horrible, horrible chemicals. And I was, again, not surprised. I, you know, thought about it, you know, what are some unintended consequences of this local law 4 being passed, and that being the federal government feeling that it has precedent over local and state government. So, you know, I think now is the beginning of a very long war, I'm going to call it, for environmental justice in the area.
Can you talk more about that, about the conflict between the local government and the federal government?
Sure. So a few months ago, the federal government, you know, gave Norlite a contract through the Department of Defense It was millions and millions of dollars. While, you know, next to Norlite are low-income housing, which I am a part of, I live in, and we have to be subjugated to these horrible fumes and horrible chemicals for the last 2 years, not knowing, you know, that these chemicals have been burning. So the state government has stepped in, and they've, you know, our local representatives, Assembly Member John McDonald and Neil Breslin, have drafted a bill to, in effect, get rid of these chemicals in New York State and ban them from any further burning. But it's been in conflict because of DEC thinking that they are more than capable of regulating the body of Norlite, which I don't think they have. So we're having a lot of internal state conflict, as well as we're going to be having a lot of federal conflict now that there's this big shipment of chemicals coming. We've heard 700,000 gallons or something like that. It's crazy. But again, I don't think it's not surprising. And I've spoken to many people, like the mayor today, John McDonald. I've emailed Neil Breslin's office, and they're all well aware, and they've all been on the phone with DEC all day today. So I'm hoping that DEC gets its, you know, head up above the water and it's protecting the residents of Cohoes, New York, and New York State.
So Judith Anks said in a statement to the Times Union that Norlite is in a tough position because there's this local law that's banning the burning of the AFFF, but they have a 5-year contract with the Department of Defense to dispose of it, which the Department of Defense doesn't seem to take into consideration the local law that has now passed. What information can you give us from the mayor's office and from the representatives that you've talked to today?
So the only thing that I've really gotten back was, I messaged everybody over email and saying, you know, here's this article. I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but this is going on, and this is what's really it's going to be getting. And the only responses that I've gotten back was, you know, from Mayor Keeler, I've been working on this all day. It's inactive right now, and it's in progress, and we'll give you updates later on. And the same thing goes for Assemblymember McDonald, was that he's been working with DEC all day long. He will get back to everyone as soon as possible. And tomorrow, if people are not aware, there is a Zoom meeting with Assemblymember McDonald on the statuses of the Breslin bill, the McDonald-Breslin bill, and a lot of other environmental justice bills that are being proposed tomorrow around 7 o'clock. And you can find that, I believe, on his Assemblymember website. But that's the only thing I've really heard. I haven't heard any really big details yet. I haven't heard what's being talked about, or, you know, I'm very much in the dark, as many people are right now.
Can you talk a little bit about what the experience is like living next to the incinerator like this? I mean, I imagine, I'm a layperson, but I imagine that burning firefighting foams is not a very effective way of disposing of them. So what are some of the things that you've noticed living near the incinerator while Norlite has been burning?
Yes. So especially in the past couple of years, we've noticed unanimously as a Saratoga sites, we've noticed horrible, horrible smells. A lot more soot on our windows, a lot more soot on our cars. And when I'm talking about soot, it's literally what it sounds like. No, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. It's black. It's very thick. It's very dense. Sometimes during the summertime when you're outside playing or just want to enjoy a fresh breath air, you know, it just, you can see the clouds coming towards you, the dust, the dirt, the soot. And then a day later, your car's covered. Just the other day, we had a really bad thunderstorm, really big rain, really big wind. And you would think that it would have cleaned the car. Well, the day later, I go to my car and I run my finger across it because I was curious. And there was already a film of whatever on the car. So, you know, for the past 2 years, and I think for the past many, many decades that residents have lived in this area, I think our basic human rights have been violated. You know, we should have the right of clean air. We should have the right to breathe air that has quality, and we can't here. And we can't move out because places are getting way too expensive, and what we're paying the cost is we're just paying the cost of being poor. And I think it's been a big thing since the 1950s of some kind of environmental discrimination. And that's a big topic in itself, but Norlite was here first, and then they decided to plan Saratoga sites here. So this has been a big battle for the past, 50, 60 years. And I think we're finally going to get something done. But, and I'm here for the whole ride, but I'm just really excited to see what's going to happen and to really follow the processes going along, because what we've been experiencing here, just to get your mail, you can't even breathe to get your mail, and you start coughing if they're really incinerating stuff. It's just unbelievable, and it's not moral.
Now, I'm glad you brought up this topic of environmental discrimination. Now, a lot of times when big projects or big facilities like this are discussed, there's often talk of jobs provided to the local community. Is there any positive side? Is there any positive feedback you're getting living next to Norlite, or is it all just toxic fumes?
I've never once experienced one positive thing from Norlite. There's no scholarships to the city or anything like that. Like, I've known other facilities to do for their towns, like in Ravenna. I think the facility that's right next to their high school, they gave them a football field. Well, I don't believe Norlite's ever done anything for the city of Cahos. They haven't done anything philanthropic for us. So no, I've never experienced anything positive. There's tax revenue, of course, and I'm sure there's jobs, but I've never met a person working for Norlite in my community, and I've never, and the taxes is just money, and I think money needs to be put aside here, and people's lives need to be put into perspective, because we have a contaminated grounds here. It's been proven. We just need a lot more tests to be done. And DEC right now is very, very against that right now. And it's not fair to us. And I don't want to wait another 50 years for something to be done. I want something to be done today.
So, Joe, as far as these tanker trucks carrying nearly 700,000 gallons of AFFF arriving in Cahos starting tomorrow, what do you recommend listeners do?
Yeah, so what I recommend listeners to do, if they're very passionate about this issue, is to contact the local representatives, contact Norlite, contact DEC, contact everybody you possibly can. Talk to your neighbors, talk to everybody, because this is not just a Cahos, New York issue. This is an Albany County issue. This is a New York State issue. This is a human rights issue. So contact everyone that you know that would probably care about this issue, and get something done. Say, we want to mobilize, we want to do everything we can. It's very complicated right now because of the virus, but I think that's one of the reasons why Norlite is allowing the shipment to come in, because we technically aren't supposed to mobilize like a protest because of, social distancing, restrictions. But I really wouldn't be surprised if you see one soon because of the fact of the abuse of power that Norlite is doing right now. And I'm not mincing any words. I'm not trying to be very, dramatic. But I've been living here for 19 years. And people have a right to clean air. And they have a right over the top dollar. So I think people need to contact people that they know, their moms, dads, lawyers, assembly members, state senators, federal senators, congressmen, everybody, and just say, we need to get things done. And it doesn't even have to be your member. Contact as many members as you want, as many people as you want, and see what happens. Because then if we can get support for the state bill, or if we can get support to the federal level, then we have the momentum. We need the momentum to go forward. And I think that's important.
We've been speaking with Joseph Ritchie, who's a resident at Saratoga Sites in Cahos, the public housing facility that's located directly next to Norlite. Norlite has a 5-year contract with the Department of Defense to dispose of toxic AFFF, also known as firefighting foam, which contains PFAS, the forever chemical. 12 tanker trucks of AFFF are headed for Cohoes tomorrow, despite local law 4, which bans the burning of AFFF in Cohoes. I'm just going to list off some phone numbers here for anybody out there listening who may want to contact their representative. You can call Governor Andrew Cuomo at 518-474-8390. You can call Senator Chuck Schumer at 518-431-4070. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is 518-431-0120. Congressman Paul Tonko is 518-465-0700. You can also get in touch with your local assembly person or state senator and ask them to support the McDonnell-Breslin bill, which would ban AFFF incineration in the entire state of New York. Joe Ritchie, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, Troy Mayor Patrick Madden speaks with HMM correspondent Corinne Carey on the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the city of Troy. Today's show features part one of this interview with Mayor Madden, where he focuses on how the city is faring and planning to weather the economic impact of this pandemic.
Hi, Mr. Mayor. How are you, and how have you been since we last spoke?
Well, good afternoon, Corinne. I'm well physically. I'd be lying, though, if I said we weren't exhausted. These past 9 weeks have been really intense and challenging every single day. It looks like that will continue for a little bit more time, but I'm really fortunate. I work with a great team, and every day we go in and try to work through these challenges, and nobody's given up yet. So we'll continue to do that, and we'll slog forward. How are you doing?
As well as can be expected at this point. I think all of us are eager for things to, we know it's never going to return to normal, but eager for, I guess, connection, you know? So yeah. I appreciate these connections. You know, a few weeks ago, I asked you if it was too early to talk about the economic impact of the global pandemic on the city of Troy. And you told me at that time it wasn't too early to ask, but it might be too early to say. Mm. But we're seeing the bad news come in waves, from the rising numbers of unemployment claims made by workers from different sectors and the closing of local businesses. I'm thinking specifically of the news of the closure of the Ilium Cafe.
Yeah, that's a terrible loss. I hope that it's limited to the Ilium and doesn't spread beyond that.
Well, the economic devastation is surely here, and I bet you're having to make hard decisions every day.
Yes, and that lately has been consuming a good bit of our time. Initially, you know, we were really worried about the health of the community and whether the systems could handle the worst of what was projected that might come our way. You know, we've continually been worried about the health of our workforce. How do we take steps to protect them and provide essential services? We continue to be worried about the youth in the community. They've been out of school for 9 weeks. Many of them are struggling to get the emotional, the educational, and the nutritional support that they get at school. But we're also worried now about the small businesses, and the Ilium Cafe is a prime example. And we're also extremely worried about the city's finances. I can't tell you a clear picture yet, but we did see that sales tax revenue across the state in April fell about 28% over April last year. State revenue fell 68% in the month of April. We're looking at a financial crisis, the likes of which we've never seen before. We're doing our cash flow projections, seeing how long we can keep staff in place. We're looking at various options. I know some communities are looking at layoffs. That would be the absolute last resort for us. Not only would you be taking somebody's job, but you'd be taking their health care in the middle of a pandemic. I couldn't sleep at night doing that. That's the last option. We're looking at furloughs or shared work programs, anything that can minimize the pain to our workforce and keep essential services going. But the truth of the matter is, if something doesn't happen in Washington, D.C., and if something doesn't happen relatively quickly, you're going to start seeing loss of services across this state.
Can you tell us about changes to municipal services? I know that the Department of Public Works, for example, just announced that yard waste removal will start on a modified schedule next week. Can you tell us what other changes we're going to be seeing?
Sure. From the outset, the steps we took were to try to mitigate the spread of the virus within our staff. So we knew that, for example, if somebody in public utility, somebody at the water plant got it, that there'd be a real risk of it running right through the water department, and then we'd have nobody to process water. We knew the same thing for trash pickup. If somebody got it there and it ripped through the staff, we'd have nobody to pick up. So we cut back on services and created like platoons of staff. And so you would come in certain days of the week and you would only work with the same people each time you came in. That impacted our ability to do the level of services that we've done in the past. So we cut out yard waste pickup. We also cut off bulk pickup. We thought those were things that were optional. Trash pickup is not optional. That's a health issue and we have to deal with that. So we scaled back to what we thought was absolutely essential. One of the things we learned quickly, though, is that, you know, everybody's home and in the nicer weather, they're cleaning their yards, and I applaud that. I'd like to see that continue. And leaf bags were piling up out on the curbs. So we had to come up with a plan to do that. This is a modified plan, and we can do it. We've created a way to do that without unnecessarily exposing workers to each other more than they're already exposed. So we're going to go ahead and do that. I think also we didn't anticipate that this would last 10 weeks. You know, we were thinking 2 or 3, 4 weeks maybe. And so we thought we could get away without the leaf bag pickup, but we can't. And that's just a reality we had to deal with, and we had to figure out a way around it. In addition to that, now the golf course is open. It's opened on a very scaled back schedule. There's no carts. You have to be able to walk the course. Start times are every 15 minutes instead of 8 minutes to accommodate for the longer time it takes to walk through. You can only go out in groups of two. You have to call ahead and pay by credit card. So again, we're minimizing the staff's interaction with the public. There is one other change in DPW. We had curtailed ticketing and towing on the days that are marked to clean your street. So you'll see on many streets, no parking Wednesday, 9 a.m. to noon. That's so we can clean the street. We curtailed the ticketing and towing because we were sympathetic to the fact that people were home. They may have lost income. We didn't want to punish them for that. But then we got a lot of complaints from people that said, you know, our curb lines are terrible. You're just going around cars. Why can't you do anything? So we have put out notice. We are going back to ticketing and towing. We will clean as many streets as we can on the designated days. So I'd urge people to look up on the telephone pole and make sure they know when they can't park on their street. They're usually in 3-hour blocks, you know, 9 to noon, noon to 3 on a particular day. And we'll get as much of that cleaned up as we can. Other than that, things are pretty much the same. You can get a marriage license online now. That's something new. And you can, I think, get married online now, too, if you choose to do that. Not very romantic, but in a pinch it'll do. Beyond that, most of our operations are as they have been over the past 9 weeks.
Are you satisfied with the metrics that the governor has set forward for reopening the Capital Region?
Well, you know, on paper, they make sense. What I would hope and urge is that we remain flexible on those and that as we come out of the gate, that if we determine one is too liberal or too conservative, we're not afraid to change it. We're not afraid to say we're learning as we move along here and make those adjustments. He did announce today that there would be limited opening in the Capital Region this week. We just need to fill some positions for tracers. I think the number was 188 or 183, but less than 200 tracers for the 8-county Capital Region area. So I would think that could come together pretty quickly. Now, this will mean that manufacturing and construction and curbside retail pickup could get started again. And it's very heartening to see this, but I, at the same time, I think we need to know what it means and what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean we've conquered the virus, and it doesn't mean we can go back to how things were in January. What it does mean is the sacrifices we've made and the inconveniences that we've taken on voluntarily have changed the game. You know, we have reduced the spread of the disease. The only way we're going to be able to remain open is if we continue those practices. So washing hands, not touching your face, keeping social distancing, and wearing a mask. 10 weeks ago, we didn't think wearing a mask had any value. Now it turns out it very well might. I mean, it's not the perfect solution, but it's one more tool in the arsenal of stopping the spread. So I think it's going to be critical, and it's going to be very hard as it becomes summertime and we want to be with friends. And, you know, you want to sit outside and have a beer. You know, we just can't do that yet.
Mr. Mayor, what do you miss the most from the pre-COVID days?
People. It's real easy. I mean, just meeting with people. I haven't been to a neighborhood meeting. I haven't been to an annual dinner for this nonprofit or that nonprofit in 10 weeks. And I'm not a real extrovert, but I enjoy that stuff. I really love hearing from people. I feel like I'm somewhat losing touch with the community because I am so consumed with the problems that this has created that I'm not out, but then I realize, well, if I was out, I wouldn't be interacting with people anyway. So, you know, I can't wait to get out again, even if it's with a mask on. I just really miss that. And I'm guessing a lot of other people do too, because I get invited to Zoom birthday parties and Zoom cocktail parties and Zoom meetings, and it's nice, but it's just not the same thing.
That was HMM correspondent Corinne Carey speaking with Troy's Mayor Patrick Madden. Keep your ears peeled for part two of this interview, which will focus in more depth on the city's budget and the decisions the mayor will have to make in the coming weeks and months.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. We're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And our next segment, a short film produced by a local independent filmmaker, shows the political drama unfolding in Quaymans, where the Lafarge cement plant is pushing local governments to allow it to burn tires for fuel.
We're speaking now with Sonia Stark, who is an independent filmmaker that has just released a short film called Albany Alert. Welcome to the show, Sonia. Do you want to tell us, briefly what the film is about?
Sure. The film is, and thank you for having me, the film is called Albany Alert, and it's a local independent film that I made over the course of 4 months to help urge Albany County legislators to pass the Clean Air Law. And it is a combination of testimony from three residents who live south of the Lafarge plant, who are in the direct path of the emissions coming out of Lafarge, and also the scientific background of Judith Enck and Mike Ewell. They are the authority figures on what TDF or tire burning fuel can do to the pollutants, the toxic pollutants that TDF creates, that pollute both the air and the water in the area. And I made the film because I was interested in doing whatever I could to create an impact on the passage of this very important and urgently needed clean air law in Albany County, which has yet to be passed, but hopefully after seeing at the legislators, all 39 of them, see this film, I'm hoping that we'll make an impression and will lead to them voting it in into law.
So you mentioned that you interviewed three residents that are directly downwind of the Lafarge cement plant. Can you talk about, you know, how you approached them? Something that struck me was that they were being harassed.
Yeah, that was a real big surprise. Barbara Heinsen, she lives on the border between New Baltimore and Quemans Hollow. She had referenced some of the controversy behind the study that showed how dangerous, how inherently dangerous tire burning is for the air and water quality. And she was one of the few, she along with Sarah, they both agreed to go on camera despite being harassed and harassed both in public and through the mail, as you saw in the film. It's a small town and politics prevail in a small town where three or four major industries hire a majority of the town to work at. And they were voices with perspectives that a lot of people consider controversial. And they, as a result, were mailed feces in the U.S. Postal Service. You know, they were delivered feces anonymously by strangers. And they had some of the town, when they were in town, some people had given them dirty looks or had said stuff to them. And I mean, I didn't highlight too much of it, but that alone really puts this into perspective, how scary it can be to be an activist or an advocate for something that should be considered a universal right, and that's clean air and clean water. And to speak up in favor of supporting that, it's really scary to hear when people who are critical thinkers and who are very smart and want to talk about it are suppressed from doing that. It's a bullying tactic. And that really threw me. I really didn't anticipate fully grown adults to behave in that manner. But yeah, so I thought it was important to reference that in the film.
Talk about the footage that you used in the film, how you obtained that footage.
Well, I have been a certified drone operator for about 6 years. And I have my own equipment and gear that I've been using for about 30 years. I am a professional videographer who's shot a number of different documentaries all around the world. And so I had all of the gear needed to make this as professional and as polished as anybody could. And I used a lot of what I would typically use if I were hired by a production team to shoot something similar. So all of what you see is from the production gear that I currently use and continue to use every day for my company, Pilot Girl Productions.
What impressions did you get as you were filming?
Impressions?
What did you learn?
You know, by highlighting the stories of those three people, I had spoken to about 10 other individuals in town who were very engaged and concerned and all had strong opinions, how they felt about the air they were breathing from Lafarge and some of the issues that they confront in their town, who came across as very passionate and engaged and authority figures who would have wanted to have talked to me, but who decided that it would be in their best interest not to because they didn't want to upset neighbors who had differing opinions. So they decided not to. So between Chris and Barbara and Sarah, those three, they were brave enough to come forward and say what the majority of the people that I spoke to were saying off camera, but they were willing to share it on camera. And I was really thankful for that.
What are you hoping that viewers will get out of this film?
Well, you know, I'm hoping this video really makes a mark on the collective consciousness of others in the area. I mean, those especially that are uninformed about the consequences of burning tires, or even those who really are in denial of the science. when you see the science that Mike Ewald presents, and when you listen to what Judith Ank has to say about the history of Lafarge, you'll realize that the propaganda, or whatever propaganda is currently being used to suppress the truth, hopefully those people will come to realize that they need to stand up. They need to take action. They can't sit silently in hopes that the DEC or the EPA will come to the rescue. Everybody in the town, as much as we would like to depend on four or five people to really highlight the dangers of this, I think it's going to take a full onslaught of the entire community to come forward and really push a behemoth. You know, it's like a David versus Goliath story, push a behemoth like Lafarge in the right direction. Because the science is there to indicate that tires can be used in other ways that make sense, environmental sense. And I'm hoping that with this film, that others will also learn more about cement kilns and how baking rock to make cement takes a lot of heat, and it's expensive, and coal is something that is, you know, is something that we need to be aware is generating a good share of the CO2 pollutants that are currently affecting climate change and global warming. So there's so much more to this story that needs to be told, and I'm already thinking about a follow-up to it.
Albany Clean Air Act that is making its way through the legislature. As far as I know, it's been sent back to committee, and we don't know when the next public hearing will be. But Sonia, where can people go to watch Albany Alert and maybe contact you or contact somebody to learn more about this issue?
Sure. www.cleanairalbanycounty.org. So you can see it on there, and you can share that link wherever you need to. You can also click on the video itself, and it's parked on the Albany Alert film itself is parked on a YouTube channel. I've made both the website and the YouTube channel. So anybody can go and make a copy of both the URL or the film itself and distribute it. And I hope they do that.
Again, that was my conversation with Sonia Stark of Pilot Girl Productions. We were talking about her short film, Albany Alert. Albany Alert tells the story of the political and environmental fight unfolding around the Lafarge cement plant in Queemans. Watch the 15-minute film at www.cleanairalbanycounty.org.
In this upcoming segment, I learned some techniques for recognizing and managing stress from my meditation teacher, Kelsey Mathis. This is Mark Russo. I'm with Kelsey Mathis, happiness trainer. Hi, Kelsey. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
So I'm really excited to have you on because this is a very stressful time with COVID-19 and a lot of insecurity about jobs and all kinds of things. So stress is showing up big time in my life, and you were a really helpful person in teaching me some stress reduction techniques in the past. So I was really looking forward to talking to you about that today to share some of that on the radio. There are some, you know, when I think of stress, there's some really obvious things that I think of, you know, elevated heart rate or anxious thoughts, things like that. But, you know, what are some examples of, you know, stress responses that your body or mind might manifest that people may not necessarily be aware of up front?
Totally. So I know for a lot of people that I know, both clients and friends, there's this overall kind of feeling of lethargy right now, or a laziness. Like you don't want to get up off the couch, your productivity is not where you'd like it to be. That's one way stress does show up, is that kind of malaise. Another way that it can show up is if you have any bodily weaknesses. So for example, I used to get migraines when I was younger. I haven't had a migraine in probably 8 years and got a migraine the other week, or for another client of mine who has a tendency towards his joints getting quite inflamed. He's like, this is flaring up, but I'm doing all the things that I'm supposed to do in order to manage it. If your body has a weakness, the stress is going to manifest physically in that way. It could be also a flare up in old habits or old triggers that maybe you think you've recovered from. A friend of mine who's been in recovery for 25 years and I have both talked quite a bit about how, like, old triggers, whether it's eating a cookie or wanting to kind of go back to a substance that numbs or dulls your senses, can pop up as well.
Oh yeah. I've been stress scrolling like nobody's business. And it's definitely not, it's not helping, but I can tell that there's kind of a dopamine hit that your brain gets from that. It's just a bit of escape. So what are some good ways to, reduce or manage that stress when it does show up?
Okay, first I'm going to share with you a technique to kind of recognize where you're at. And when I shared this with my therapist, she was like, I'm stealing that. So I'm going to share that with your listeners.
Sweet.
And then I'm going to share a breathwork technique that you can start to implement, as well as a gratitude technique. And these three things together can work to kind of, A, give you access to where you're at and knowledge and recognition that that's okay. And then from there, a little bit of work to minimize that stress feeling. So the first one, I don't have a lovely name for this, but so it's modeled after a traffic light. So basically, first thing in the morning, wake up, you know, have some water, check in with yourself. And this is preferably before you hit the news cycle, before you go do your stress scrolling for the day. First thing, you really just want to kind of check in. And what I like to do is label how I'm feeling as green, yellow, or red, right? If I'm feeling green, my day gets to progress as I've planned. I'm going to try and be as productive as possible. I'm going to try to stay on the schedule that I pre-planned for myself. If I'm yellow, then I know that I'm going to need to do a little bit of extra self-care that day, because that means I'm going to be kind of easily triggered into a stress response. So I will take off what isn't necessary from my plate and maybe prioritize a little bit of extra time to be outside or to do artwork or something else that brings me joy, but is kind of a mindful exercise. If I'm in the red, then anything that is possibly negotiable comes off. I might reschedule a client meeting for the following day. I might push it till later in the afternoon if I can't reschedule. But I'm really going to prioritize that self-care even more, because when we're in the yellow or we're in the red and we try to push through and be productive to the extent that we expect ourselves to be at home, we're just going to burn ourselves out that much faster. And we're going to actually put labels on, like, our lack of productivity as being lazy, which just feeds that stress response later. So if I'm in the red, I'm really going to do everything I can to just take care of myself and follow what's going to make me feel good so that I can get back to being in the green. And I have found that when I honor those feelings and I reimagine my day to fit where I'm at, I can bounce back a lot more quickly and a lot more efficiently. So I might spend a couple of hours in the red, but I give myself permission to, like, take a nice hot shower or go for a walk or whatever it is. And usually by that afternoon, I'm feeling much more inclined to get back to whatever it was I wanted to be doing. So I really highly recommend checking in with yourself at least once a day, first thing in the morning, and to react accordingly. And really challenge yourself to take judgments off of it. It's not a bad thing to be in the yellow. It's not a bad thing to be in the red. You're not a bad person because of any of that. However, when we honor it, we can kind of work with ourselves and parent ourselves through it a little bit more easily. So the next thing is, when you are feeling stress, if you're feeling kind of that heightened heart rate, if you're feeling anxiety, if your monkey mind is just going crazy, a really easy breathwork technique is called the 2X breath. And that simply means I'm extending my exhale twice as long as my inhale. So if you have time to sit down in a comfortable position, close the eyes and breathe in this fashion for say 3 to 5 minutes, that's great. But if you're in the meeting, in the middle of a meeting and you feel like, oh my God, I'm just getting really triggered, I'm getting amped up, you can still use this with your eyes open and it's going to be effective.
Because so like breathe in for a 4 count, breathe out for an 8 count, something like that.
Yeah, I usually start with an in on 2 and an out for 4, and then extend from there 3 to 6, 4 to 8. But what this does when we extend our exhale is it triggers our parasympathetic nervous system to recognize that it is in fact safe, because it's forcing our breath. Like when you're sitting, hanging out, watching Netflix, doing whatever, like your breathing is easy. When we're anxious, it's high in the chest and it's moving quickly. So what we do to combat that is to extend that exhale out. And by just how our nervous system works, it cues our body into a sense of safety.
Great. And so we're just about out of time. So before we run out, you said you had a quick gratitude technique, which might be interesting to share. And then if you have more information for folks to be able to seek out resources online or elsewhere, please share that with us.
Excellent. Yeah. So gratitude technique is another really simple one. You can do this while you're brushing your teeth in the morning or while you're in the shower. Just attach it to something that you're already doing every day, because that will remind you to do it. And then you just begin each sentence either in your mind or out loud, depending on what you're doing, with I am grateful for, and filling in the blank. And really just challenge yourself to go, I am grateful for blank, and do that over and over and over again for 2 to 3 minutes. And you'll be amazed at how quickly you feel better, because you do recognize that you're surrounded by so much abundance. And pro tip, even if you have nothing to fill the blank in with, just know that thinking the words I am grateful for gives your mind an opportunity to begin literally rerouting its neurons towards abundance and towards happiness. But you can join me to meditate. I'm teaching classes online for free every week, and you can grab all of that information at meditatewithkelsey.com. I'd love to have you guys join me.
Great. Yeah. These techniques are so helpful for me, because I find oftentimes when I'm stressed, I kind of spiral out, and it's easy to, like you said, with the malaise and exhaustion, just wind up like just laying around and not feeling good at the end of the day. But if you can take small steps to physically change what your body is doing, your mind often follows. And that's why I think they're really helpful.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, Kelsey, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to meditating with you online soon.
Sounds good. I'll see you there.
Now that was me, Mark Russo, talking about stress reduction with my meditation teacher, Kelsey Mathis. And you can sign up for free online meditation classes and get a download for those techniques that she discussed in the interview at www.meditatewithkelsey.com.
And we're going to close out the show with our final segment that features HMM correspondent Michelle Masurjan, who speaks with Brenda Robinson, DNP, City of Albany Human Rights Commissioner, founder of Black Nurses Coalition. Brenda Robinson speaking about her virtual telepathic clinic phone buddy program and the need for leadership accountability in dealing with health disparities in communities of color.
My guest today is Dr. Brenda Robinson, Doctor of Nursing Practice, who is the City of Albany Commissioner of Human Rights, founder and CEO of Black Nurses Coalition, president of the Arbor Hill Neighborhood Association, Albany Library Board trustee, and has worked more than 27 years with the Veterans Administration. Welcome, Dr. Robinson.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You are a very busy and sought-out person. I've seen you on 2 health disparity panels this week that I'm aware of. I want to start and thank you for so graciously taking the time to speak with me today.
Sure.
So I understand you have a telemedicine practice. Can you talk about your practice and the community that you serve?
Yeah, sure. We've always had a community health virtual, and BNC has been around for so long now, years are just passing by so quickly. But early on, we saw the need to incorporate telehealth. So that was one of our first focuses because we knew the need. In my experience with the Veteran Health Administration, I knew just how positive and effective telehealth can be. So instituting telehealth was very beneficial. It's also a cost savings, and it also provides a lot of access to folks who typically do not have that type of access. So it's been a plus all the way around. Since COVID-19, of course, you know about healthcare disparities and social determinants of health, which actually are so intertwined and creates a higher risk for folks with comorbid conditions to be at more risk for COVID-19. So being able to provide our virtual clinic, and we also included something called the Phone Buddy, because we were expanding so much and everyone did not have the same need. So we have grown at least by 60 to 70% with the Phone Buddy. And people are so comfortable. I get calls from all over. And we see a lot of issues because, of course, the people in our community, I serve an underserved community, majority minority. We have a lot of fear, a lot of different issues, a lot of distrust. And, you know, with COVID-19, there are so many unknowns. But one thing that we do know is that Black and brown people are dying.
Yeah.
So that's where you get the fear. And our phone rings, rings, rings. Whether we're out getting medication for someone who couldn't afford it or too scared to go out and get it, whether we're doing medication reconciliation when it's folks wind up with so many medications they don't know what to do with them, we still do the education because there's so many messages out there. We reassure, we do coaching, we do a lot of same things that we've been doing, but at a higher rate and more detail, because I think our residents need more, right? But I even have situations such as I have one gentleman, an elderly gentleman who has a wound, but his healthcare providers didn't show up because they're afraid of coming in the building because of COVID-19. So, you know, this pandemic is causing so many difficulties and barriers and things that you may not have expected. So we have to be on it and ready.
So what are some of those things that are happening that you didn't expect?
Well, one is just like the gentleman I just mentioned, when he first got on our program, we had him all squared away with wound care and all these different things. Well, now what we thought was set is no longer set. So the folks that we deal with, things that we think are good are no longer good. When I get my client finally on board with taking their high blood pressure medication, right? They're doing a great job. And then 3 days go by and I'm checking on this person, I find out that they ran out of their medication, haven't been taking it, didn't want to speak up, and they couldn't afford to get the refill.
Yeah.
So some of those things are just falling by the wayside. Even with diabetes, a person run out of test strip, they are expensive if you don't have insurance. So I may have people who I've been coaching all along and they're doing great and they're just stellar. And then this hits and now we're like 4 or 5 steps back because of this situation. More barriers have been put in place, so healthcare is more difficult.
So, the African American communities and, you know, other Black and brown communities have dealt with these health disparities, environmental injustice, food deserts, you know, poor housing for decades. Talk about these social determinants of health and what are leaders not getting? What do you think is just not happening?
Well, I think one of the things is, for one, healthcare disparities just have been around since decades. Even the Institute of Medicine even did a report, you know, decades ago, and so many other scholarly entities. So it's not like folks don't know. I find that it's a lot of excuses, such as, you know, and I have, you know, we talk about different biases, and implicit bias is always labeled, but we have to remember about the explicit bias. Everything is not implicit bias. I'm tired of hearing that providers don't know. Yes, providers do know. So we all are aware of these healthcare disparities, so we need to address it. COVID-19, the devastation on Black and brown people should not be new or a surprise, because it certainly is not a surprise to me. Holding people accountable oftentimes is difficult, but this is the time that we really have to hold folks accountable. The excuses have to stop. We have to acknowledge the lack of access to healthcare for Black and brown people. That is real. And, you know, we really have to address it. I find that a lot of funding goes, may go for healthcare disparities on the basis of the demographics, but that funding does not go to that same neighborhood where the funding was obtained. So it's so many different issues and angles that are going on, but I'm not gonna listen to elected officials tell me, oh, we need the data for COVID-19 so that we can address the healthcare disparities. You already have data about healthcare disparities. You already know the maternal mortality rate for Black women was 3.3 times more, a Black woman 3.3 times more likely to die from a preventable pregnancy as compared to a white woman. So we know these things. We already know about diabetes, where a Black person is 2 to 3 times more likely to get a limb amputated due to diabetes compared to a white person. You got all the data you need in regards to healthcare disparities. We need the action and we need the funding behind it. So we're not gonna hide behind these stats. We're not gonna hide behind, oh, I need this data, because you have the data.
So in that vein, Governor Cuomo did say he was now, yes, it's horrible, and we're gonna do more for communities of color. What do you see coming up next? What would you like to see moving forward to improve the health?
I think moving forward, for one, I want to see some real accountability. And you know, when I talk about accountability, I'm speaking about those folks who are making decisions, but I'm also speaking about people like me and people who look like me and other people in this community. Mm-hmm. You need to hold your leadership accountable. So when you go in that voting booth, and all of you do need to vote, because that's a big way to change things, but stop voting for people if they're not holding up their end of the stick. I mean, these are the people who you put in place to really be your voice. If they're not being your voice, then you know you need to make some changes. So one of the things, first and foremost, is really that accountability and holding people accountable. It's nice to like someone. You know, I like a lot of people, but not all those people do their job well. So, you know, and our lives are dependent on these people doing their job well. My life depends on it. So we have to be more serious and I think more actionable about, you know, what we do and how we do it. You know, also, let's not forget the transparency, the honesty, and the trust, because people of color do not have that trust, and we know why. We know about the medical apartheid. We know about the history and how Black and brown people have been treated. So let's not pretend that we don't know really where we came from and what we're up against. So the trust issue is there. But we need to build on that. And I think leaders need to be purposeful in trying to build this trust, because it can be done, but we can't move forward without that. You also can't move forward with plans for people who look like me when you don't know me. You have to add me into the equation and give me a voice for an effective plan. Your plan is not going to be effective unless you include folks who look like me at the table.
So I apologize. We're going to have to wrap it up.
I just would like to thank you for having me on your show. It's very nice, and it's very nice to meet you. And, you know, this is a bad time, but I am glad that the cover is pulled off of healthcare disparities, and now folks are forced to acknowledge and take action.
That, again, was Brenda Robinson, DNP, City of Albany Human Rights Commissioner and founder of the Black Nurses Coalition on Healthcare Disparities, with correspondent Michelle Mazurjan. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you would like to comment on our work, send us an email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.